Saturday evening, Continental Flight 1404 taxied onto the runway at Denver International Airport, headed for Houston. But shortly after the plane began to accelerate towards takeoff, things got scary.
Everything was fine for a while, and then suddenly we all felt the plane kind of turn to the left. It was almost like taking an off-ramp on a freeway, and you're like, wow, I didn't know a plane could do that.
It just seemed like it took forever for the plane to stop. And on my side of the plane, I could see the engine. I noticed it was on fire.
A gentleman right in front of me went to open the emergency exit on my side, which was engulfed in flames. And I batted his arm away, and he stopped, and we all went to the other side.
The plane cracked open and, as you heard, burst into flames. Yet when rescue crews arrived on the scene, they found the plane evacuated passengers and crew walking up the hillside toward them. Of the more than 100 people aboard, all survived. 38 passengers sustained injuries. Reports today say they are all on the mend. It seems like luck. Anybody hearing the phrase plane crash associates those words with catastrophic death tolls. But based on the numbers, in fact, far fewer people die in plane crashes every year than in car accidents. If you've ever been in a plane crash, tell us how you made it out. Call 800-989-8255 or email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Amanda Ripley is the author of the book, The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes, and she joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you.
I should stipulate that the NTSB is still investigating this crash. We don't know exactly what caused it. From what you know, was this a particularly dangerous event?
I think it was extremely dangerous, and it was also typical in important ways. I mean, to the degree you can call a plane crash typical, this was typical in the sense that the plane ended up on the ground. Most plane crashes happen during takeoff and landing, and the plane ends up on the ground and on fire. And you have very little time to get off the plane before the plastics become toxic.
As soon as they start to burn, they give off odors that will kill you.
Yes. So the whole trick is to get off quickly. So your performance as an individual and as a group matters a great deal. Whereas I think as a collective imagination, we tend to think of planes just dropping out of the sky. And there's nothing for us to do other than, you know, scream in unfettered horror.
The obviously, takeoff might be more dangerous than landing because the plane is full of fuel.
Well, that's an interesting point, that the plane could, the fire could get more ferocious more quickly. But in general, most plane crashes happen during takeoff or landing. So, you know, both are dangerous if there is an accident at that time.
Now, in this case, you said so much depends on how passengers and crew work together. Again, from what you've heard, this is very early days yet for this kind of an investigation. Did this crew and these passengers work together well?
Well, I have seen a couple of interesting things from the survivors. One quote was, passenger said, "Whoever was on the left side exit row, God bless him, was Johnny on the spot and instantly had the door open." It's extremely important. If you are going to sit in an exit row, you need to be Johnny on the spot. You need to pay attention to the directions and visually rehearse how to get that door open. It's not easy. It's quite heavy. So that's extremely important. People can die if you take too long doing that. So I think that was essential. There were problems, though, just as there are in most plane crashes. Again, typical. People went for their overhead baggage. This is very classic in all kinds of disasters. We heard about this on 9/11 in the Trade Center, people gathering their possessions even as the flames, you know, licked at their backs.
Obviously, they tell you all the time you don't take your possessions with you. In fact, you should kick off your shoes if you're going down that slide because they could tear the slide open. The other thing, we might opt for the exit row, which of course has the door on the side of it, because a little more foot room.
Right. That is probably not the ideal reason to sit in the exit row. But I understand that inclination. If you're going to do it, though, you need to know that you're a Johnny-on-the-spot kind of person and that you're paying attention. There is actually research that shows that people who listen to those passenger safety briefings and read those silly cards actually do have a better chance of survival.
Even if you're flying a 727 and a 737 and you've been on Southwest a zillion times?
Right. No, that's not what you need is some kind of short-term memory vitamin for your brain so that you can visualize.
You could sell a bunch of those.
Yeah, exactly.
As you're looking through this, other things to remember, your seat belts, for example, they do check on those. Incredibly important.
Yes. And I think, you know, the most important thing is to realize where the exits are before you take off. So it really takes 20 seconds to count the number of rows between you and the exit. And you want to look for more than one exit. We had several passengers on this plane point out that there was one exit that was overcrowded and another one that was much more quickly available. So you don't necessarily want to all head to the same exit.
And count the number of rows between you and the exit. So in the dark, if there's smoke, you can just go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I know I turn right here.
Right. We need to sort of start thinking about plane crashes as fires. They're fires. They end up as fires. And in a fire, you need to be able to get out as if you're blindfolded.
And again, if there is fire and smoke, it's better air down low.
That's true. And you will often see, the only thing you can see, I've gone through some simulations of this, and with smoke in a plane, the only thing you can see are the track lights often on the bottom at the aisle level. And so that's where you want to be, as close to those, and keep following them towards the door.
If you've been in a plane crash and obviously survived, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us your account, talk@npr.org. Let's begin with Matthew. Matthew with us from DeWitt in Michigan.
Hi, my name is Matt. I actually was a flight attendant for a year out of high school. I'm now happily going to college up in central Michigan. However, I did go through three emergency landings, one involving the flaps fail, or two of them involving flap fail, and one involving the computer just shutting off. But one of the things I wanted to bring up was pilot fatigue and also flight attendant fatigue. Little do many people know, pilots and flight attendants can actually go for 16 hours straight in one day and then only be given about 8 hours of sleep. And then they start up right the next day, able to go up to 16 hours. And so I wanted to hear what your panelists had to say on that and to bring that issue up.
Well, Matthew, we're talking about crashes today. It sounds like you weren't in any.
Actually, I was in especially one in New York City. And a big problem, one of the big reasons was mechanical, but also pilot fatigue.
And what happened in that crash? It's what we're trying to get at here, Matthew. Would you tell us your story?
The flaps failed. One of them was stuck up. One of them was stuck down. It was quite windy. And actually, we turned around to go back to, I believe it was JFK, and the controllers told us, you know, they would rather have us go to another airport because they didn't necessarily want to deal with our emergency at the time. So we actually had, in an emergency situation, to go to a different airport, and we had to land there with quite a windy situation, and it was a really hard landing.
Everybody got out all right?
Everyone did get out all right. Everyone was safe, but it was just surprising, you know, how it was handled, both from the controller aspect and also from the point that our pilots, you know, couldn't act as well as they probably should have been able to because they had not been able to get very much
rest. We'll get to that point in just a second. What airport did they send you to?
LaGuardia.
So it's just the other side of Queens. It's not.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing is they're close geographically on the ground. But when you're in the air, you have to go back up and circle around and reposition yourself completely, which takes a lot of time.
And I guess everybody's. That was a plane full of passengers?
Yes.
All right. Matthew, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that story, I'd be pretty alarmed if we had a crisis and they sent the plane off to another airport. But I guess there might be reasons for that.
It may have been safer for them to land at LaGuardia. I don't know the details of that, but I do think that Matt makes an interesting point, which is that not only pilot and crew fatigue can affect your performance, but also passenger fatigue. Some of the worst plane crashes, actually the deadliest plane accident in history, happened after the passengers had been delayed for 7 hours or something, and they were waiting all day, and they were exhausted. And that affects all of us. So your brain doesn't function very well under extreme stress, and it functions worse when you're tired.
Is that the disaster at Tenerife?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
This was two planes colliding on the ground.
Right, a KLM jet and a Pan Am jet, a terrible disaster in which most people on one jet survived the initial impact but then didn't get off the plane in time and were killed by the fire.
Let's get another caller on the line, and we'll go to John. John with us from Phoenix, Arizona. John, are you there?
Yep.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
It was 1972. I was first year in the Navy, and we were leaving Phoenix for Los Angeles on a Continental Airlines 707. And at that time, you could actually watch them working, and they were changing the tires on the airplane and delayed it about 45 minutes. When we landed in Los Angeles, as soon as we touched down, all of the tires on the main gear caught fire, and the fire was obviously underneath the wings. The landing gear collapsed, and the plane skidded to a stop, and everybody was immediately hustled out of the plane. There was a Chinese man next to me who did not speak any English, and he must have been an architect because he was carrying a number of long tubes like they carry plans in. And you could tell he desperately wanted to save them. But as we were ushered out of the airplane down the aisle, the people around him were knocking those out of his hands because he was trying to hold on to them and still get down the aisle. But everybody made it out. I believe that said the incident report, because I was a Navy pilot, two people did have heart attacks but survived.
I'm glad everybody made it out okay. Of course, the heart attacks are pretty scary.
It was rather scary.
Yeah. What he's saying about the architect trying to hold on to his tubes, that's one thing, Amanda Ripley, that I'm sure that sort of thing happens all the time.
It does. It's remarkable when you see the footage from firefighters. Fire trucks at airports often have cameras on them, and you can see this footage of people jumping down those emergency escape slides with their rolling bags with them, and they become sort of like missiles, right, at that descent. So they're quite dangerous for you, for everybody else on the plane. But I don't think it's just necessarily people being foolish. I think that there is a sort of normalcy bias that kicks in under crisis, and you try to do the things that you normally do, which include cling to your carry-on baggage for dear life.
I guess that's natural. Also, people who don't speak English, how are they supposed to follow instructions? This happens all the time. John, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate that. We're talking about those who survived airplane crashes. Please give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And our guest, just to remind you, is Amanda Ripley, writes for Time Magazine and author of the book, The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes. And let's see if we can go to Bruce. Bruce with us from Ann Arbor in Michigan.
Hello.
Hi, Bruce. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Can I name the airline that I was on?
Sure.
I was on Singapore Airlines, and I was flying into Kathmandu in Nepal. And it wasn't until after this happened that I was told that Kathmandu Airport apparently is one of the most dangerous airports to land in, because Kathmandu sits in a bowl surrounded by the Himalayas. And we were coming down to the single runway at Tribhuvan Airport, and we were approaching the runway, and we hit a wind shear, and the plane just literally dropped out of the sky and slammed down to the airport. The tarmac, and bounced several times. The landing gear was totally demolished. We were forced to evacuate via the emergency exits and the slides. And I've got to say, if it wasn't for the great work of the Singapore flight attendants, that it could have turned into a much greater disaster than it actually was. No one ended up, to my knowledge, no one ended up getting injured, but the plane was totally taken out of commission.
Wind shear, Amanda, the more terrifying scenario of your plane is flying along and then it's smacked down into the ground by a tremendous force of wind.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because what Bruce is saying reminds me of the fact that, you know, the training of the flight attendants is so key here. And we didn't understand this until in the 70s. There was a streak of terrible crashes in which passengers did nothing. They didn't move very quickly, if they moved at all. And they learned that flight attendants need to be trained to literally shriek at you in order to get people to move. And then people move.
Oh, they were shrieking. I can guarantee you that they were shrieking at us to move, yes.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. They've actually done research on this, and if flight attendants are polite and friendly at that moment and quiet, it's the same effect as them not being there at all. So the shrieking is jarring, as you probably experienced, and I've only heard it in simulations, and it's a little frightening, but it does have the desired effect.
It was interesting, too, because for whatever reason, as I recall, not a single person on the plane even thought about getting their baggage or their belongings. Everybody was just really interested in getting out of that plane as quickly as possible.
Well, that's great, and that's probably a testament to the passengers' preparation and also the leadership of the crew. You know, if people have some information and some warning and they're given very aggressive orders, they tend to move really quickly. It's quite remarkable how obedient people are in crises like this.
Bruce, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Glad you made it. Let's end with, this is Scott. Scott with us from Cincinnati in Ohio.
Hi, I'm with you.
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
I turned on the radio to WXVU, heard your discussion, and called. I was a pilot on board a DC-8 flight out of Mexico City in September 2001. We were taking off a runway 5 left, and an Air France 777 pulled out on the runway in front of us. We were doing about 110 knots and had to abort the takeoff and skid, and went off the runway at that speed and just barely missed the 777, but we went airborne as soon as we left the runway. And fortunately, it was real muddy. We came back down, traveled about 1,000 feet through the mud, tore off the two inboard engines a little bit, bent back a landing gear, and managed to walk away from it.
Wow. That's you were lucky it was mud. You're right.
Very lucky. But, it's a pretty frightening experience.
Scott, thanks very much for the call. And again, we're glad you made it. It is astonishing the number of people who survive airplane crashes and the stories that they have. Those people in Denver, I'm sure they're still shaken. We did get this by Claudia by email. I've never been in a crash, but since opening the emergency door is so important and vital, why not have an area in the airport where you can practice opening such a door so people can give it a try? It sounds like a good advice.
It's an excellent idea. Interestingly enough, that very idea was proposed in the UK and in the government after a terrible crash, and it disappeared from the radar. What we find often is that airlines and airports are not particularly excited about the idea of talking about plane crashes, which is unfortunate because I agree people would be very eager and interested to experiment with it. What else are you going to do when you're waiting at the airport?
Amanda Ripley, a senior writer for Time, author of the book The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
One correction before we go. Earlier, I credited Shepard Fairey with designing Obama's campaign's O logo. That was not one of his creations. He designed many of the most recognizable Obama posters with a striking image of the now president-elect's head and shoulders coupled with words like hope and progress. The O was created by a graphic designer named Saul Sender. We apologize for the error. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.